I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Poshnosh Gal, and today I'm joined by the remarkable chef Taylor Bonnyman. A Londoner at heart, Taylor refined his culinary skills with the likes of Marcus Waring, Daniel Boulud, and Paul Liebrandt before opening the highly acclaimed and Michelin-starred Five Fields restaurant in Chelsea. I'm so excited to be chatting with Taylor. He has quite a reputation for shying away from the limelight. So, Taylor, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm very well, very well on this grey Friday afternoon.
Yes, very grey.
But we're all fine. We're all fine. Thank you.
And hopefully we're coming out the other end now. But how was your time over lockdown? And tell me about how you felt when you heard of the news of closures.
When they advised everyone to stay away from restaurants a week before, that was worse than the actual enforced closure, because there was no support, there was nothing, and we just saw the reservations just going into free fall. So there was a bit of open water to cover there between the first admonition and then the actual legal requirement to close. That was hard, but the actual lockdown itself, the novelty wore off pretty quickly. I'm sure it did for many people. Scary times, really. But we opened at the beginning of August, and it was going really well. The goalposts have been slightly changed with the curfew. We'll see how that goes. It makes it quite difficult. I'm not gonna lie. So fingers crossed we can get through, and hopefully they'll lift it sooner rather than later.
And how much of a difference does that 1 hour make to you? Well, it's a couple of hours, isn't it? I mean, you'd normally finish at 12.
Yeah. 11:30. Well, without a limit, we can take reservations up till 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
When we came back, we knew we weren't going to have as many customers, so we changed our whole business plan from being an a la carte and tasting restaurant, which requires more personnel. So we lost a few personnel. We went to one menu only, tasting menu, which takes longer. But you rely on getting people in over the course of the evening. Now we have to get them all in either at once. It's like the McAllister family leaving for Christmas. It's complete chaos.
Yeah,
at 9:59. It makes it pretty rough, and no one wants to eat at 5:30, unless it's the weekend, and even then it's rare. So it is, it's tough for us. I'm sure it's even rougher for other restaurants out there. Because it takes 2.5 hours to eat, but we've had to modify the menu again so that people can get out in 2 hours. Our last sitting is 8 o'clock, which is really tough.
Yeah. And obviously, your restaurant, it is an experience. So it's not a place where you want to just eat and go. You want to enjoy it and take your time.
Yeah, well, hopefully, that's the food and the service is one thing. It's making people feel very special. But the quality of food should be implicit. But people come to have a good time with their company, and we're just there to kind of facilitate that and hopefully entertain you along the way. But we're not, we've never tried to be the stars of the show, just something that can enhance someone's evening.
And going back to just over, what you did over lockdown, did you spend any time near your vegetable gardens in Sussex?
That's where we stayed. We got out before they pulled up the bridges, and so we were down there living with my parents for 2 months, which was
wow, that must have been interesting.
It was very nice. We weren't invited, so we just showed up. So I'll bite my tongue. It probably wasn't great for them either.
Well, if you can't do that with your parents, then who can you do it with, right?
They're probably exactly. Yeah, it was pretty rough. But we came back. We came back sort of the end of June, and it was gorgeous. It was, the tough part was keeping our 3-year-old twins occupied, And, you know, like everyone who has small children, it is a grind, like just getting through the day sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do sympathize with anyone who had to also work, or had a partner who had to work. At least, you know, I wasn't doing anything, but we got to see the change in the seasons, and they got to, you know, experience the garden as living in London. They haven't really seen that. So, and they, you know, were too young before. So that was nice.
Yeah. And you've got three acres out there. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Yeah. And so the gardens it supplies the restaurant.
Yes. Yeah. So because the menus had to adapt, we're using the garden as the starting point for everything, really. We've even started shooting the deer, that kind of, you know, gabber at the periphery in my parents' fields. So we're getting quite a few deer from there as well, which is fantastic. So,
yeah, you know,
I'm not sure that I'd be able to pick out an East Sussex deer from my parents' land as opposed to another one, but it is lovely, you know, when you're serving something.
Did you grow up shooting?
No, I haven't shot a thing, but I really ought to give it a whirl. And I've no qualms about shooting something to eat it, but maybe some practice targets before I start blasting the countryside.
So what was it that inspired you to start and develop your own garden?
When I was working in New York, we used to go to the Green Market a couple times a week. And, you know, I worked with a guy called Paul Liebrandt out there who was very, very into, you know, these you know, unusual herbs, shoots, vegetables, and deploying them, you know, with devastating effect. You know, just, you know, it lightened his food, and it was gorgeous. And I'd never seen any of that in London. Perhaps Tom Akins was doing a little bit, with his little roof garden when it was still up on Elliston Street. But it was really more about sourcing good stuff. So we thought the only really effective way to do that was to grow it ourselves. And now it's grown into much more than just a kind of herb and micros garden. We grow an enormous amount of vegetables. David Love Cameron, our gardener, gets an awful lot of produce out of that acreage. He used to have a walled garden back in Ireland, from which he was supplying lots of restaurants, and he does it by himself. It's amazing, really. So we give him our kind of a very broad brushstroke menu plan. In the beginning of the year, we kind of like to try this, this, and this. We really like this. We didn't like this. This worked out for us. This not so much. And then he'll put it into his planting garden plan, and so gives us a month's heads up as to when we should expect stuff. The real tragedy was this summer we had to. It's not a tragedy, but we couldn't use any of it fresh. We had to move quite quickly to preserve and juice and, you know, you know, process all of this stuff that was coming in droves, and with no restaurant.
Yeah.
So that was a bit of a shame.
How did you manage? I mean, what did you do with it?
Well, we get a lot of brassicas, so, you know, summer cabbages, kohlrabis, beetroots. So you know, we some of the vegetables we cure, so you're essentially burying them in salt and sugar and, you know, drawing out, treating them like a piece of meat, almost like jerky. Some of them we juice, use the, you know, ferment the juice, and you kind of replace, you know, what you might conventionally use vinegar or lemon juice for with vegetable juice, which adds, you know, greater complexity. Lactic acid is a lot softer, creamier and more savory than citric or acetic acid. So it's really good for finishing, and you it's a bit more forgiving as well, because you can add a bit more without destroying your sauce at the point of sending it in service. So it's quite a handy little store cupboard things, and obviously a lot of fermenting things, which is handy just to bring a bit of acidity and freshness to what we're doing.
Well, that's great that you're still managing to, you manage to use the produce, and, having your own gardens that's such a good business strategy, and you get to probably save so much money on certain products. We came to the restaurant, your team explained that each year you have an away day there.
Yeah, we missed it this year, of course. Normally we go down, and last year, 2019, we had a little food truck came up, and we just had a party, and
so much fun. Yeah,
it was great. All the guys got to walk around the garden, and it's nice to get out of London as well. Apart from anything else, it's nice to see where we're getting all this stuff. But it's not a kind of research field trip. It's kind of downtime, and it is their weekend, of course. So. Yeah. But it's nice. It's a lovely spot.
Yeah. And so did you manage to retain most of your staff?
Yes. So we lost one of our guys upstairs. Just our hand was forced, but we had furloughed him, and we made sure that he was okay and had found other employment. One guy downstairs had already given his notice. We were able to furlough him because he hadn't been in his other, new job for long enough to be eligible. So we helped him out. And unfortunately, three short-term hires downstairs we couldn't bring back. They'd only just started in the month right before the furlough scheme was introduced. So all in, we lost five.
Okay.
It's a depleted, but we have a good staff retention anyway.
Yeah.
And it's not the way I'd have it, but we just, the numbers don't really, they don't lie. So we had to make adjustments quite quickly.
Of course. So going back to the restaurant, I mean, my husband and I, we, as I mentioned earlier, we've been there, and I thoroughly enjoyed our experience. It's probably one of the most beautiful looking meals that we've ever had. And you love working with flowers as well, and you also grow your own flowers in the garden, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. So the other great thing about growing everything yourself is you see that the entire plant, you've got the root, stem, petioles, tendrils, flowers, seeds, and also stuff that you just, it's very difficult to get hold of these green spices while they're still juicy. It's a very narrow window: green coriander seeds, green fennel, green caraway. So you get to see the whole life cycle of the plant, and you can use different bits at different times accordingly. And it's taken a long time for us to learn when to be prepared for that, because it is so brief, and these ephemeral changes it's nice to respond to. And if you can get yourself ready and prepare a good dish where it would be suitable, then it's a dream. But it takes a few growing seasons to get ready for that.
And you touched on the menu earlier on. How much does the garden drive your choice of menu?
Now it determines everything that we do. I'm not a vegetarian at all. I'm a total omnivore. But I do now. I like to, we structure the menu the way we like to eat. Really, we like to finish with a meat protein.
Mm-hmm.
But leading up to that, lots of vegetables, seasoned with meat and fish, really. That's kind of how we go about it. We cook and we garnish with the proteins rather than the other way around. And it makes you work really hard. We don't have that many courses on our menu because we like people, even before the curfew, we don't want people to have to spend more than 2.5 hours sitting if they don't want to. You know, you're welcome to stay as long as you like in normal times, but you know, it shouldn't be a 4.5-5 hour marathon. You just get a sore back, as, like, as you said, you're sitting there.
Exhausted.
So you kind of work hard to just showcase the stuff that you're getting from your garden. It's also hard in central London to give a lot of meaning to what you're doing when it's coming from 40 miles away. It's not like you can see the garden out the window. So we try and do our best to make a fuss. Right. Of this stuff, because it is good, and you know, sometimes we succeed, sometimes we don't, but you know, we try our best and try and give it a voice and make it all make sense.
You were quite young when you opened the Five Fields. You were just in your 20s. What was it that made you open such a classic fine dining restaurant?
Yeah, I was 27, which is, I'm 34 now. And I can't believe, you know, 27 is very young. I realize now. But I think I wanted something timeless because, and I'm grateful now that I really didn't know what I was doing, because you know, we've never been confined by a kind of fashion or a trend. It is quite, you've seen yourself, it's relatively timeless. It's a very orthodox, quite a formal restaurant, although we try and make the service as professional but informal as we can. You know, serious food cooked by very unserious people. You know, I think we've grown into the restaurant. Whereas at the start, obviously, like anyone who opens a restaurant for the first time, you don't really know what you're doing at all. And it's just nothing in your head really belongs together. And trying to, you know, you do have to just get on with it and cook. And some people obviously take to it quickly. For us, it took a little longer. 2.5-3 years in, I think we sort of found our stride. But it took a long time, like teaching ourselves, learning how to cook the way we wanted to.
And it was a very big step for you at the time, given that you hadn't spent any time as a head chef yourself before.
No, I mean it was a little unexpected. We were looking for a property. And I think that the assumption was that would take, you know, a year, 2 years. And, you know, in the meantime, I'd be kind of doing what I'd always done, but you know, trying to find finishing schools in a way to continue working. But I think it took 48 hours to find wow, this building. Yeah. So, plans change quickly. And I'm glad I didn't know then what I now know about opening a restaurant and operating one, because I think I'd have shied away from it. It's something you should do kind of half blind and slightly ignorant of how much it's going to consume your life.
Well, it took something like 2 years to actually build the property in the first place, and during that time, you worked in New York with Daniel Belude and Paul Liebrandt. How did you manage the project remotely?
No, I'd actually come back from New York, and I was planning what to do next, and I thought I might go back out to the US. I'd lined up a trial at, for some reason, at Jean Robuchon out in Las Vegas, and I'm not sure I would have come back from that. certainly not the same person, but I had to, I canceled that. So, I'd come back. So the next 2 years was me trying to assume some gravitas as a, you know, you know, auditing these project manager meetings and trying to throw some kind of sensible insight into like how to put together a restaurant and actually just not knowing what the hell was going on.
Before we dive into that, I actually wanted to just talk about your time in New York and your experience working with such a culinary royalty. Do you have any fun encounters from your time in New York?
New York was amazing. It was the most formative period of my life, not just cooking. I met my wife there, just the whole thing for that, for the age I was a tremendous education. Just an extraordinary city, great people, a great industry. The hospitality industry out in the US is really open, really affable, and yeah, they're just excited to see one another at their colleagues' establishments. So that was great. I ended up working for some interesting people. When I was at Daniel's, the pastry chef there was Dominic Ancel. So I was working in the hot kitchen, and I asked to transfer to the pastry. He hadn't done any of his bakery stuff yet. He was still very much under the Dynex Group umbrella. So yeah, he was a fun guy. His desserts were wonderful. But now that I think about it, there was not just one menu. There was like a fruit dessert menu, and there were six desserts on that, and then there was a chocolate dessert menu, and there were five desserts on that. It was a huge operation. So I was lucky to be there, and I met some interesting people in both restaurants at Corton.
Do you still have a relationship with Dominique?
I don't. I'd love to see him. He probably wouldn't remember me though. probably just that weird clueless English guy who talked a lot.
So did you end up getting transferred then? And how much did you actually learn did you learn from him, or did you just like pick up stuff together? How did it work?
Well, I did transfer in the kitchen, because I love the desserts there. It still is a gaping chasm in my, knowledge is pastry. Fortunately here we've got Van, our pastry chef, is doing marvelously. But I deliberately wanted to at least kind of plug that hole and learn a bit. So I was there for 6 months.
Right.
And in the production side of it, I did a little bit of service as well, but the production was really where you kind of the work happens, and services, you're just sending it out really.
Right.
Particularly for that menu.
And did you spend any time with Daniel Boulud or Paul?
Well, he was even then, he was at a different point in his career. He was there a lot, but he was a restaurateur, the face of this huge group of restaurants. So he had other things to do than hang out with us. But I did see him quite a bit. Very nice guy.
Right.
Total wild man. I spoke to him a little bit just kind of in passing, but he definitely made an effort to find out about everyone who was working in the kitchen. And there was, he came to people's leaving drinks and stuff. And yeah, he'd be the first person up on the bar with, mixers. He's a complete madman. A really
Did
nice
that happen
guy.
With you? Did he have the mixers with you when you were leaving?
No. I was a far too marginal minor character in the brigade to merit a visit to my leaving drinks.
And so, I mean, With your work now, I mean, I can see inspiration from Paul's style in your presentation and creating beautiful plates, but it seems like you add much more complexity to the dish.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say. I think, yeah, Paul Liebrandt, he's out there by himself. He's more divisive. I think probably he would frown on some of the orthodoxy that we adhere to here. I think, you know, he some of his stuff was a bit more challenging, but when I was there, that was what I wanted to see. I wanted to see like him, both he and Daniel Ballou, they were very open and happy to talk about why they were doing things. And there was a reason for everything Paul was doing. You know, it wasn't just, you know, an ingredient dartboard, or, you know, he wasn't just, a technique freak or anything. He did have a classical background. He also had a, you know, extraordinary understanding of modern techniques, and he had an amazing knowledge of an appreciation of food across the world, and to bring that all together, I thought was just I thought it was terrific. So he's taught me a lot, and I think just as a kind of inspiration character, he's still very useful to refer back to. Not always, yeah. But you know, it's kind of, if you're ever, you know, I don't know, if you're ever looking to go off piece a little bit, you know, what would Paul do?
Right.
But I think we try and cook for the five fields now, not really, you know, that's what I meant, like at the start, you do tend to imitate what other people are doing, and it never works. Yeah. You can never pull it off.
Well, after a while, and your head chef is Marguerite Koch.
Marguerite Koch, yeah.
So how did you both meet?
We met when she was the sous chef at Marcus Waring. She worked for Marcus for 6 years, and we became good friends. I was another grunt in the kitchen, you know, causing problems for people, and you know, we just became very good friends and stayed in touch. And I knew she was, you know, kind of around in London. So when this project became an option, I knew her, I'd worked with her, but I didn't know her so well that, you know, it would be, you know, compromising some kind of friendship. Obviously we're, you know, more like siblings now. We've worked together here for 7 years. Mm-hmm. So we have a very, you know, good relationship.
Yeah.
But it kind of worked, and she was senior enough to, you know, help me set up the restaurant and collaborate with, but not so much so that it wouldn't be interesting for her to leave her job, in a way, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And how does that work between you both? I mean, how much of a collaboration is it between you guys?
I was very close. I mean, the job I set myself now is just kind of is purely putting dishes on the menu and just, you know, working on that. Marguerite has some on there. Charles, our sous chef, Van, obviously, in pastry. So we do work together. I try and, you know, to justify my existence, I try and make sure that the kind of lion's share of stuff that's going on the menu is, you know, stuff I've worked on. So otherwise I might as well just kind of stay at home. But no, we're at a good point. I'm really happy with the team that we have, and Marguerite runs the kitchen incredibly efficiently. I'm really happy with that. We've got good people down there, so it does free up my day just to kind of look at what we're going to put on next. And obviously the menu is quite a lot smaller now, so you can go on kind of deep dives into the stuff that's coming in from the gun. Sometimes it works, often it doesn't, but you know, we eventually managed to put something, always something new. You know, I'm always keen to do something new. But I learn a lot from Marguerite and Charles and Van. You know, it's nice to be surrounded by people that you are still learning from.
What is the story that you want to tell through your food?
Still figuring that out, really. I you know, I think you want a snapshot, a Polaroid of the season. I think vegetables do that really well. It's another reason, you know, they're so good to use in the kitchen, because you can tell exactly what week of the year you're in by looking at the menu. Whereas, you know, if it's a slightly more conventional menu, which is protein led, and that could really be, you know, there are very few proteins that are that specific to that part of that month. So I think we're just trying to make you feel the weather. I like to use the weather a lot as an inspiration. So even if it's, you know, early October and it's sunny, which it isn't at the moment, you know, you can modify the dishes so that it feels a little bit lighter if you're having an Indian summer, for example.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if it's turning, you can quickly, you know, cook accordingly, have something a little bit more robust, dishes that are a bit more broad-shouldered, that are more fitting for people's you know, predilections at the time. But balance, I think, you know, we like to, you want that steady progression. And I think, you know, just cooking the tasting menu now, I understand that a bit more, that there has to be, you know, dishes do have to complement each other, not just within the dish, but across the menu. And, you know, just overfeeding people isn't that clever, and it's not that difficult. So you do have to be careful that you're not just overloading people and with any kind of monotonous set array of textures or you know, techniques where it gets kind of pappy, and, you know, your palate gets tired, your waistline becomes stressed. Yeah, we're here to feed people, of course, but you want it to coincide with the end of the meal, that kind of sense of satisfaction and being full.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the attention to detail, because you, in one of your dishes, you had this kind of succulent. It was like a little miniature succulent, and they had like little kind of, I want to say water droplets, but it was like...
The ice plant.
Oh, it's just beautiful. I've never had anything like that before.
Yeah, so David, the gardener, he said to me, in his Belfast accent, I won't try and do it. You're probably not going to use these, are you? And you've been so excited about growing them. And I was struggling to, you know, get this set dish, but they'd just come in, and get the balance right. It was a little bit, you know, too heavy. I was trying to, you know, lighten it a bit. And this, then I just remembered that they were going to flower, these little ice plants.
Yeah.
And the buds, they look like a cactus almost.
Yeah.
And they've got this lovely solidity, like quite acidic, fresh, crunchy.
Yeah.
And I would never have thought of it if we hadn't just spoken about it. So yes, there are some little candied walnuts on there, a kind of set ponzu gel, and these little ice plants, and some you know, reindeer lichen on top. So it's even though it's the difficulty with that was giving the dish texture, because a set is quite a creamy thing. It's got these coconutty white chocolate tones to it, so it can get a bit tiring if you're having two dishes of it, and you know, it's just introducing that acidity, that texture, and something unusual.
So you opened in 2013, and it was 3 years until you received your Michelin star. Describe the moment that you found out.
Really relieved, actually. If I said that we weren't hoping for one, that would be an outright outrageous lie. But I think by the time we were awarded the star, the restaurant was awarded a star, we felt we were ready to live up to the award and and bear that responsibility. Because I think it is a responsibility that, you know, it's a bit of a leap of faith that they take, giving independent restaurants that they can't control bestowing these awards. So the restaurant has a lot to answer for when they do. So we've always tried to exceed that rating, I guess.
But it
was great for business. It was great professionally. We were really happy. I suppose it's easy to say now, but it's not something we think about every day. Now it's like we sat down and we're all thrilled, and we said, right, well, now we can actually get on with cooking. It's it was great. So it was a bit of a weight off our minds. We felt almost, when you have a restaurant like this, you're responsible for it, and you don't have a star, there's a bit of pressure there, and people whispering in the back, like, oh dear, But that's never the case, I now realize. And it's just a plus. It's nice to be awarded it, but it's hard work. You gotta
and live up to the grade. Not easy either.
No, it's every day is different.
Yeah.
And we try and make sure they're not quite so different as they used to be, but we are more consistent than we were in 2016. And I think we've grown up a lot, and the restaurant has matured, and I think the guest experience has got better. We hope that we can improve it further. So even to quote what I read at the bottom of every newspaper article, in these extraordinary times.
Yeah, exactly. And so what is it that makes you happier? Is it being in the moment of creating and cooking, or is it the joy that someone gets from eating your food?
Both. I think I became a cook because there's this instant gratification of seeing people enjoy what you've made, and you don't have to be that patient. You have to be a bit patient, obviously, making your dish or whatever it is. But once it's ready to serve and you've nailed it, it's a really addictive thrill to see people just smiling and enjoying it. And I think growing out of that, just enjoying being at the table with people. And I think as my time has become more stretched, I'm more appreciative of sitting down and sharing a meal with people than I was when I was 27.
Yeah.
When you don't have dependents and you seem to have a lot more time. I don't really feel like I have any time now. So to actually enjoy a meal at a table is just wonderful. But creating is really fun too. And now I think, rather than one-off dishes that you're throwing together and you think, oh, fantastic, what a moment of genius I've just had. I think, a job well done, and the craft of putting it together, organizing how it's going to work, and sending it out on the first night and it not going up in a ball of flames, that's very satisfying. I think Matt and Jay, the general and restaurant manager, probably get thoroughly sick of me pestering them, saying, what are they saying? What, you know, how do they like it? Well, they didn't say anything, but the plates are clean. So I'm guessing. So yeah, it's still the slightly puerile, excitable, you know, hassling. What did they say?
Oh, love it! I absolutely love that. So what is your earliest memory of food that sparked your love for it?
My mum's a really good cook, family style, tasty, not fussy, but you know, she's always cooked. She cooked all my meals when I was little. I'm an only child, and you know, everything was fresh, and so my dad and I were, you know, thoroughly spoiled. Nothing in particular. I guess I've thought about it a lot, because I've been asked before, that a friend and I used to throw together potions from her spice cupboard and just tip everything into this, you know, so she'd come back and she'd be just incandescent because all her spices had made it into a big horrible soup of mess, like this, like ghastly foul smelling paste.
But
we loved it. It was, you know, every day and try and sneak off and, you know, see what kind of potion we could make before my mum came running in and
and fixed it.
So yeah, exactly. It went down the drain or in the bin or whatever.
And so you're actually a history graduate and briefly became an accountant. What was it that made you think, I want to become a chef? Like I can, you know, make a profession out of this.
I don't think I'll be held up as a model alumnus by the university. You know, if you work hard at your history degrees, you can become a chef. And I was the world's worst accountant, so that was a brief dalliance. I was always greedy and liked eating at restaurants. I had done like holiday work when I was and stages from 15 onwards in kitchens and restaurants, and it was kind of, I realized it was quite a good way to, you know, get attention from girls, and then, you know, even better excuse to say, why don't you and so and so and so and so come over and I'll cook, which was quite novel when, you know, we were 19. So that kind of worked in my face.
It worked out well for you then.
I wasn't a very good cook, but you know,
And so, I guess your love for history is where the name for the restaurant came from. For anyone that doesn't know, Firefields was the name of the area in Chelsea in Georgian times where the restaurant is located today. And the produce was grown on the fields, which was then sold into central London. And Taylor, how interesting is it that you're now taking your fresh produce from out of town to the fields that originally supplied it to London in the past?
Yeah, it's from what I know about the Five Fields, it was what I like about the name of the restaurant is it's such a, you know, fancy part of town now, and you know, all glitzy, and it's far removed from how the Five Fields was, which was this really ropey, awful place with, you know, you get your throat slit quite easily. And before the embankment was built, this was part of the Thames tidal plain and floodplain. So it's marshy and, you know, load of ne'er-do-wells. I think it was also part of, you know, one of Henry VIII's many hunting estates down there by Thomas More. I think he was a local boy as well. So, it's quite an interesting, connection. But we struggled with the name until we started, you know, in desperation, we started looking at old maps, and there were some good names on there, like Hell House and Bloody Bridge. It gives you a flavor.
Call it Hell House.
Yeah.
Mind you, there is Hill House.
Yeah, there is Hill House
on the road.
Yeah, just up the track there. Exactly. I see them in their bright orange regalia sort of marching around.
Yeah, used to be me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. long time ago.
But it's a nice school up there.
Sorry?
It's a nice school up there.
Yeah, it was. I was there from, I think, from kindergarten to the age of, I think it was 10 or 11.
Oh, small world.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it. It was a lot of fun. And what I like about it is they've got buildings all over Chelsea. So you spend a lot of time moving from one to another.
They must do, because I see these kids in throngs just, you know, coming out of every doorway.
Yeah. Right, well, we're digressing. It's not about school. but I just thought that was such an interesting, fun fact about the restaurant and the area that it's in, and that you're actually supplying it from your own garden. So, and so you've also named your private dining room after John Raccoux, who mapped out the area in Georgian times, which I find super interesting as well. But tell us what your thought process was behind naming the room after John Raccoux.
He was the cartographer. He was the guy who produced the map. I just said that. So again, the desperate scanning and scrutiny of maps helped us out. And we've actually got, I don't think it's, it used to be in here, an original. It's a print of one of his original maps of, you know, Chelsea and the five filters on there. And I think he's the one who included the details about Hell House and Bloody Bridge. And actually, Pimlico didn't quite make it in, but I was born on Tatchbrook Street, which I learned that in I don't know if this is true, but someone said in you know, Middle English, it means shit creek. So it's kind of... they weren't shy with their street names.
No, they weren't. And actually, I even had a look on good old Wiki. Actually, had a look at the map by John Raccoux, and it was broken up into multiple sheets. And I think you are actually on sheet A3, and I'm on G3, which is South London. So I was going to ask you if you've got an original map there. So, I think that's pretty cool if you've got.
I think an image of the original map, or a print anyway. But I doubt. I don't think it's the original. I'd give it back if it was the.
So it's so inspiring for people looking at building concepts. I love the way that you've come up with that, and it's interesting. It's an interesting and different way to look at things. But while we're on the subject of inspiration, what kind of advice would you give to a young aspiring chef of today?
Eat out as much as you can. Expose yourself to as many different styles of food as you can, because it's not a one size fits all. You can learn a lot from eating other people's food.
Yeah.
It's such an exciting world, and expressed so beautifully by so many people, and it's a wonderful industry. But don't get sort of siphoned into one direction, in one lane. There's a lot of cross pollination from people. One regret that I have is that I never worked in a kind of high volume kind of brasserie, you know, get them in, get them out. And, you know, I think that's useful for everyone at some point in their career to work in, you know, both, you know, low covers, high end, and middle market, high volume. You learn a lot of bad habits almost anywhere you go, it turns out. As I've learned over the years and observed, but I think it's just a yearning to have some kind of kitchen confidential experience. Maybe that's poor advice.
Well, I think it's great advice, actually. It's pretty cool. I think eating out is so important, and you know, discovering different flavors and tastes and the way people operate and the way they work. And would you recommend to anyone that, you know, would be thinking of opening a restaurant, would you recommend jumping in the way that you did?
No. I couldn't recommend doing that. That was I wasn't ready. And I didn't have the business acumen or the culinary ability at the time. And you know, one inevitably suffers at the hand of the other. If it's like that, you do need to, you know, at least have a bit more time under your belt cooking. In my case, and then you know, surround yourself with good people though. And I did, and you know, it's paid dividends. But you also need to know your weaknesses and your shortcomings. That, you know, you can't be everyone's everything all the time, and no one, God knows, no one's perfect. So you know, there are things that you need to lean on other people as well, and you know, don't micromanage them, and you know, it's not one person. It's like an organism. A restaurant, it's like the kitchen is the kind of one of the vital organs, and the front of house team is, you know, the kind of the mouth and the right hand, and I don't know, you know, the porters are the joints, and you know, the wrists, and you know, facilitating all of this stuff. And yeah, you know, it's a small, it's like a ship.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a kind of man of war ship.
Yeah. It's quite interesting the way you're actually painting that picture. I've never looked at it in sort of, you know, human biology sort of but that's pretty cool. And yeah, you're all, you know, it's like you're all one person, you know.
Yeah, and you have to work in synchrony, really. Because if you've got the outliers who aren't really marching to the, you know, beat of that drum, then it becomes pretty clear. And
yeah,
you know, you do have to work very closely together. It's I always think it's like one of those leaky buckets in team building that you have to try and plug with your fingers, and yet there are always leaks. No matter how well you fill the gaps. And it's the same with a restaurant, you know, there's always something that needs doing, and there's always something that's about to go wrong, if not going wrong at that very moment, that needs your attention. So you have to be.
So you mentioned, you know, eating out is still a really good thing to do. And is it something that you still do on a regular basis, or?
Not as much as I'd like. But my wife is wise to me now. She knows that at any given opportunity we'll end up sitting down for like a 10,000 calorie feast somewhere. And you know, so she closely monitors the reservations I make for us. Our honeymoon was the least romantic honeymoon ever, you know, just because it was just one silly restaurant after another, one amazing restaurant after another. But
where were you?
We were out in, she's American, so we got married in Utah, and our honeymoon was in Napa and San Francisco. So we you know, I made sure that we hit five consecutive, you know, over the top restaurants on our honeymoon. And by the time
amazing, that's a brilliant honeymoon.
I know you know, such an ingrate she is. We did kind of pass the pain threshold, so no, I don't get to eat as much as I'd like now, but you know, any excuse. And it doesn't matter what kind of restaurant it is. It could be you know, something quite humble, or it could be, you know, ideally something where it's totally hedonistic, but you know, I don't always get my way.
And do you have a favorite in London?
No, I've got four or five favorites, but I'm not gonna name names. They could probably tell you themselves, like, you know. and you don't want to. Before I became a cook, it was easier to, you know, go to restaurant. But before I was sort of, you know, known, I guess, in London. I doubt I am even now, but it was easier to go to restaurants regularly. And now there's a sort of professional obligation not to go too much to someone else's restaurant. You know, it's just kind of feels like kind of corporate espionage or something, which it's not. It's just because I really like going and, you know, but you don't want to show up every week.
The downside of being a known chef.
Oh, for me.
And other places. Yeah, that's never thought of it that way. But yeah, that is a bit of a shame. But I hear you have a rather eclectic taste in music, the Brian Jonestown Massacre.
Oh, how'd you know that?
Do my research.
I'm waiting for live music to come back as well. Like that would be wonderful.
Yeah, so you hadn't seen them. You haven't seen them live before.
No, I've seen them a lot.
You have seen them live.
No, I've travelled all over to. I'm like, you know, a hysterical groupie, but it's a good night out. They're always they always put on a good show. And, you never know kind of what version of the band you're going to get or what kind of mood they're in. Whether they'll play for 4 hours or play for 1 hour, it's. I think they too have become, and it's really one guy, but they've become a lot more mellow with age. So you don't get all the bullshit that that kind of ruins a gig, actually, to be honest. But great music, not great to put on in the kitchen because it's a bit, you know, jangly and distorted and.
Yeah, I must admit, I listened for a little bit and I was like, this is interesting. It's interesting. It's, you know, I think you kind of, you know, you can get used to it.
Yeah. It's quite eclectic, some of it.
Yeah.
He likes to toy around with different genres and very prolific. You know, so again, Anton Newcombe, great inspiration, professionally, not personally.
Well, what other inspirations do you have in the chef world?
Oh,
who are your big inspirations there?
Oh, I like anyone who demonstrably loves what they do. You know, starting with my own colleagues, you know, it's great to see them enjoying their work, hopefully enjoying their work. But I always think Brett Graham is a sort of reference point for, you know, anyone in our industry. He just works incredibly hard. I don't know him that well. I've met him a number of times, but, you know, everything I see, he does it, you know, 110%. He doesn't half-ass anything. And I think that's, you know, something that everyone should aim for. I don't often achieve it, to be honest, you know, but I think there are a few who do. But I think he's a great figurehead, as one example. There are many, but you know, anyone who sticks at it with one restaurant essentially, and, you know, obviously he's got a pub, but makes that a lifelong project. I hope the Ledbury comes back. You know,
it'll
I hope that
interesting to see what happens next, and maybe we'll be, you know, starting a new restaurant and just, you know, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'll certainly travel there.
Yeah.
Exactly. I might even drag my wife along if she is. Poor girl.
You got to be in disguise though.
No. You imagine if my wig fell, even worse if your disguise is revealed. So, like that mad New York Times critic who used to dress up and have the restaurants.
Yeah, that would be hilarious. That would be brilliant. So, Taylor, it's been amazing getting to know you. Just, I have one last question for you, though. Tell me something about yourself that I couldn't possibly know. Bearing in mind, I'm great at research.
I kept a police caution from a few years ago, but that, you know, maybe that's a little too serious. I spent a night after a late evening with friends. I spent a night swimming downriver against the incoming tide from Putney Bridge to Chelsea Bridge. Wow. In Thames. So I was in there from about 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
That's quite funny. What possessed you to do that?
I tried to walk all the way home along the river, and the path runs out somewhere just under Putney Bridge. So I ended up leaping across. This was a long time ago. I ended up leaping across people's kind of walls just above the sluice. And I lost my footing and fell in the river. And I couldn't get out. If I'd gone about 150 yards back, I could have climbed out. But I was tired and emotional after my late session with friends. And I thought, right, well, I'm going to keep on head down. Yeah. The good thing about the Thames is right under the waterline, because it was high tide as well, it was coming in, there's chicken wire all the way along. So I was able to drag myself for about, you know, I'd say 800, 900 yards quite easily. And then I had to get out into the main part of the river to get around the trees and, you know, past the boating clubs and stuff. So
that is brilliant.
Probably about as close to death as I've been, but
well, you made it. Well done. That's such a brilliant story. Thank you for sharing. I'm interested in the police caution, though.
I had my earphones in. It might surprise you to learn it was another late evening. I was on my knees with my earphones in, and eyes closed, playing some really good air guitar in the middle of the road. And fortunately, the next car that came along was a police car, and I denied all accountability. So they threw me in the drunk tank for the night.
Oh my God.
They gave me an £85 fine. Again, a long time ago.
Pretty harsh.
Yeah, I know. I thought I was absolutely charming, but not charming enough to avoid a night in the cell.
Oh no!
Idiot.
Oh well, that sounds like that is actually a really good story. I like that one. It's quite funny. It sounds like you've got lots of them, so we're gonna have to do this again.
Hopefully, no more to come. I think that's probably it for me.
Yeah, but, late night stories from Taylor Bonniman.
fireside stories.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been so much fun chatting with you. Unfortunately, Taylor is not on social media. However, you can follow The Five Fields, which is the restaurant, on Instagram. And I'm at Posh Nosh Gal, and also now on podcast. So thanks again, Taylor.
Thank you. It was lovely to meet you.
And you. Speak soon.
Take care. Cheers. Bye.